Okay, let's go to Parshas Vayera, Seder Vayera, and the Haftorah Vayera, and the connection between the Haftorah and the Seder. Okay, since it's only Tuesday, I am in the beginning stages of developing this, so you're getting the first draft. Okay, what it'll look like on Shabbos, I'm not 100% sure, but I found some very interesting ideas already in preparation for my Shabbos drasha that this year I told you I'm going to speak about the Haftorahs and the connection to the Sedra, and I'll share them with you, and maybe with some good questions or comments, you'll give me something more to say, and then I will blame you for my drasha being longer than it should have been. How much what? How about? Oh, you can divulge it, it's okay. Most people are sleeping anyway, so this will be the only pair. This way will be the chance for them to hear it. Okay, in any case, the simple, what does the Haftorah of Vayera speak about? The Haftorah of Vayera speaks about two incidents with Elisha. The first incident is with the wife of Ovadia. Ovadia, the prophet's wife, in the time when Achav was killing out all the prophets, Ovadia hid 100 prophets in two caves, 50 in each cave. And he did it at his own expense. And the Sfarim say that because of that, his family went without food, and he died and left his family paupers. And they had nothing in the house, and they were in debt. And the debtors, creditors came, and were going to take everything from them. And the poor widow came to Elisha, and she says, "You know that my husband risked his life and basically put us into bankruptcy to hide the 100 prophets when Achav wanted to kill them and support them. And now we have nothing in the house. And the creditors are coming and things look pretty bad." So he said, "Do you have anything in the house?" She said, "Yeah, I have one vessel of oil." He said, "Fine, take that and go borrow as many vessels as you can. Empty vessels." And this is the miracle of the oil. She poured that oil and it never stopped. Just kept going and going until she filled up every vessel she borrowed, and then the price of oil went up, and she was able to sell it at a tremendous profit, all this oil, and she was able to pay off all her debts and support her family. That's the first thing. The second one is, Elisha is traveling, comes to the city of Shunem, and there's a great woman there, who her and her husband host Elisha in their home. And the woman comes up with a great idea. Since Elisha comes often to the city of Shunem, so why don't we build him a little addition to our house, a little table and a chair and a bed, so he'll have a place. He won't have to rent a hotel. He won't have to feel that he's bothering us. And he'll have his own little room. Whenever he comes to Shunem, he'll have his own little apartment, and he'll be able there to sit and learn Torah and do whatever prophets do. And the husband agrees, and they make him a little room. And then Elisha wants to show his gratitude. So he says to the woman, "Tomorrow is Rosh Hashanah. Do you have anything you want me to speak to God about that you may need?" And she says, "No, just leave me as be part of my people. I don't want to be singled out." And then Gehazi, Elisha's servant, his Mishores, says, but she has no children. And so Elisha says, "Fine, next year you will be hugging a child." And she says, "Please don't play games with me, right? You're going to give me a child, give me a child who's going to survive, right?" And Elisha said, "Next year you're going to be hugging a child." And sure enough, the next year she has a child. And then the end of the Haftorah is what happened to this child later. The child grew up, and he was a youngster, and one day the child had a headache, and the father sent him home from the fields. He went to his mother, and she laid him down on the bed, and she held him, and then he died. And she came to Elisha, right? She wouldn't tell anybody what happened. She didn't tell her husband. She went to Elisha. She finally got the message to him that the child had died, and she expected Elisha to do something about it. So Elisha sends Gehazi to go and put his staff on the child or whatever, and to lie down on top of him, and nothing helps. Finally, Elisha comes. He lies down on the boy, right, and gives him what appears to be CPR, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and brings him back to life. Brings him back to life. And this is one of the miracles of Elisha, that he brought the child of the Shunamis back to life. Now, what is the obvious connection to the Sedra? This Sedra speaks about Sarah, right, being remembered by God, getting pregnant and having a child. And when was she remembered? On Rosh Hashanah. And here is exactly the same thing. The woman of the Shunammite had no children, and she's remembered on Rosh Hashanah through the prayers of Elisha, and she eventually becomes pregnant, and a year later she has a child. So, very close relationship. But there's much more here that's also connected between the Sedra and the Haftorah, besides this obvious. First of all, the first incident, where the wife of, Kliyakar says, what merit, finally, I mean, they had a lot of merits, but what were the two merits that Avraham and Sarah had that enabled them to have children? So the Kliyakar says, when the angels came, they said to Avraham, Ayo, where are you and where is she? And he says, it didn't mean physically, geographically, where are you? But where are you holding? What are your milas that you're going to deserve to be told that you're going to have children? The mila of Avraham Avinu was his chesed, his taking care of guests. And the mila of Sarah was her tznius. She was modest, way in the tent. She wasn't making a spectacle of herself. She was a modest person. So tznius, modesty, and hachnosus orchim, receiving guests, were the two milas that Avraham and Sarah had to have children. Now, if you think about it, the wife of Ovadia was zocha that her children should survive, right? Even though they had nothing in the house, what schus did she have? The schus of hachnasas orchim. What did her husband do with her? Okay, supported 100 prophets and kept them in caves away from Achav, which is hachnasas orchim. So here we have the beginning of the Haftorah also has a connection to the Sedra, insofar that the wife of Ovadia also did chesed, and hachnosis orchim, and because of that her children survived. This is similar to the fact that they had children in the schus of hachnosis orchim. Another thing, why did the Shunamis end up having children? What was the merit that she had? Same thing, hachnosis orchim. She built a little apartment for Elisha to be machnis oreach, right, to take care of a guest that came through the city from time to time, the Navi Elisha. And because of her hachnasas orchim, because she built him this apartment, therefore he, prayed for her for a child, she had a child. So again, there's a connection. It's the hachnasas orchim that preceded the birth of Yitzchak, similar to the hachnasas orchim that preceded the birth of the Shunamis. There's another connection. Yitzchak was born, and then God told Avraham to slaughter him. And the Medrash says that out of fright, Yitzchak really died on the altar by the Akedah, and God resurrected him. In fact, it says that the bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem, Mechaye HaMeithim, was said by the angels when Yitzchak was resurrected, when his soul was restored to him after the Akedah. He died of fright. He saw the knife, he died, and God resurrected him. So we have Yitzchak, who's born because of Hachnasas Orchim, who then subsequently dies and is resurrected, exactly like with the Haftorah, the boy who's born because of the Hachnasas Orchim of his mother and father, and then he's resurrected when he dies. So it's an extra similarity. And the, another thing is, it says that there's a connection between resurrection of the dead, which happens in both the Haftorah and in the Parsha, and birth. So it says there are three keys that God does not give over to a messenger. He takes care of himself. What are those three keys? One is birth, the other is the resurrection of the dead, and the third is rain. Now if you think about it, rain is really just another manifestation of birth and the resurrection of the dead. Which bracha in Shmoneh Esrei do we mention rain? Right, Mashiv Aruch Marivat, Tchias HaMeisim. The bracha that ends, Tchias HaMeisim. Why? Because rain brings the seeds, which are basically like dead and rotting, to life. It's like Tchias HaMeisim. And also, the fact that the rain brings out vegetation is like giving birth to it. And it says in the Haftorah for Atinus, right, Ki Yetzer Yageshem in Hashemayim V'Holido V'Hitzmicha. And it brings, it's like gives birth, right? By raining on the ground, it brings out things from the ground. It's like giving birth. And it's also compared to Tchias HaMeisim. So those keys of birth and Tchias HaMeisim are similar to the key of rain, which has a connection to both of them. So these two aspects, birth and the resurrection of the dead, are something that God has a connection to directly. I was thinking, what is this idea? And therefore we find in both the Haftorah and the Sedra the idea of a miraculous birth, and at the same time a miraculous resurrection of the dead of that person who was born, Yitzchak and the son of the Shunamis, who we'll see in a second who he was, and who he ended up being. I was thinking, why birth and the resurrection of the dead? What's the connection? Connection is like this. Birth is bringing the soul into this world. The resurrection of the dead is bringing the soul into the next world. And there's a connection between this world and the next world. You can't have a next world if you don't have this world. This world prepares for the next world. And it's like, what's it called? A plant growing. The Meiri says, the Olam Haba is like the fruit of this world. Here you plant your world to come, you plant the seeds, and you reap the results in the world to come. So there's a tremendous connection between this world and the world to come, like plant growth, which is generated by rain. But how has it come about? Person's soul comes into this world, into a body, functions in a proper way, and then deserves to go on to the world to come. So God is involved directly with birth, bringing the person into this world and to the next world. But it only works if a person understands that he's only temporarily in this world. He's only a guest in this world. And God takes care of that guest in this world, takes care of all its physical needs, in order that he should be able to go on to the next world. So therefore, the concept of hachnosas orchim, when I deal with guests who are not permanently in my place, they're temporarily there and they need a place to stay, it's like hakbalas pnei hashchina. I'm emulating God. What does God do? He takes care of the guest in this world. Which guest is in this world? The neshama. The neshama is a guest in this world. And God takes care of all the physical needs of the neshama in this world in order to make it possible they should be able to go back and be able to be in the place where he is for permanently in the world to come. So taking care of guests is emulating God. God takes care of the guest who's the neshama in this world. You take care of the guest who is temporarily in your place and see to it that he's able to function and get back to where he's supposed to be permanently. That's exactly what this world is all about. And that's why God has a direct connection to birth and Tchias HaMesim. It's the two ends of this journey. One into this world in order to be able then to journey into the next world where you are eternally there. Now, Tznius is the idea of playing down. Tznius is the idea of playing down the externals in this world. The main thing is not the externals. The main thing is the internal. So Tznius is being modest, is saying, don't direct your attention to the externals. There's more here than meets the eye. The internal, the neshama, is the main thing. On the other hand, hachnosis orchim is taking care of the physical needs of the person who's there. And both of those are necessary if a person's going to get through this world. He has to take care of his physical needs and function physically properly, but always remember that he's only a guest in this world. And his main place is the next world, so the main thing is to do things in this world physically that aid the neshama and that support and promote the neshama and not things that contradict the neshama. So both of those qualities, tznius, which represents the fact that I accent and accentuate and emphasize the inner, the neshama, and hachnosas orchim, that even though the neshama in this world is a guest, but you have to take care of the guest too. You only take care in the permanent place, you take care in the temporary place too. You take care of the physical needs of the person in the place where he is, temporarily, so he can get back to the place where he's going to be permanently. Same thing. Take care of the physical needs of the neshama in this world so you can get back to the world of the souls eternally. So those two milas were the milas that brought Yitzchak into the world. That Avram and Sarah understood the concept of tznius, coupled with the idea of hachnosas orchim, that's what a person's purpose is in the world. So in order to have children, to bring them into the world, you have to be able to understand what you're bringing them to. You're bringing them temporarily here to be able to transfer them eventually to Olam Haba. Now, if that's the case, we can understand why, in the end, these two miraculous births, the miraculous birth of Yitzchak and the miraculous birth of the Shunamis' son, both ended in the children dying and being resurrected. Because it wanted them to understand you have something very special here. You had a child brought into this world miraculously. Appreciate that his purpose is not just for this world, that there's something beyond that. So God made it work out that both of them should die and be resurrected, that they should understand how important these children are. That bringing a child into the world is not just to take care of them in this world, but to make sure that they're able to go beyond this world too. So both of these parents who were zoche, the children who came into the world miraculously, were taught that lesson intensely by having the children die and resurrected, so he should know how to deal with the children properly. And that's why after the Akedah, Avraham Avinu sent Yitzchak over to Alki Yeshiva to learn. Till now, he felt he could take care of him in the house, he went around with Rosara or whatever, but after the Akedah, he said, if the whole purpose is to see to it that this child's going to get to Olam Haba, then let me send him away to Yeshiva. Now it's important that I get him out of the house and put him in an environment where he's going to get the most Olam Haba can. Hold on one second, I'll answer the question and we finish. Now, who was this child? Habakkuk. The prophet Habakkuk was the son of the Shunamis. Why was he called Habakkuk? Because he was hugged twice. Two hugs. Once he was hugged by his mother, right, when he died. She held him, right, until he died in her lap. And then Elisha hugged him and brought him back to life. So Habakkuk is called Habakkuk because of the two huggings that he had from his mother and from the Navi. And this represents exactly what we said. What is we learn from Habakkuk? The importance of both worlds. The mother's hug is this world. The Elisha's hug is Tchias HaMesim, is the next world. And what did Habakkuk teach? What were some of the lessons that Habakkuk taught in his prophecy? One is Habakkuk came and taught that the entire Torah rests on unbelief, on emunah. Emunah is that idea that I believe in God, meaning I have trust in God, I believe in Him, that He can take care of all my needs in this world, and I believe and trust Him that He's going to take care of me in the next world. So that's one thing. There's another thing it says, if Habakkuk prayed that people, Talmidei Chacham, should not be poor in this world. They should be able to take care of their physical needs. They shouldn't have to learn Torah with two people sharing one garment. They should be able to be taken care of, and their physical needs be taken care of. This is the idea of Habakkuk. Habakkuk, the two hugs. The hug of the physical world, the hug of the spiritual world have to go together. And you need the physical world, which is represented by Hachnosis Orchim, taking care of the guests' physical needs in this world, taking care of the Neshama's physical needs in this world, and Tznius, understanding though that the main thing is not what you can see, the main thing is behind the scenes. So Habakkuk therefore prayed that people in this world, their needs should be taken care of, even though they're learning Torah, the main thing is the next world, this world's also important. You need both. So he taught this lesson of having the physical needs taken care of as well as the spiritual needs. And also in Habakkuk, we have the sentence, Halichos Olam Lo. What do we learn from that pasuk? You say it every day. Halichos Olam Lo. Right? Korashona Halachos Bechol Yom, Muftach Lo Shu Ben Olam Haba. Someone who learns Halachos every day is guaranteed to be a Ben Olam Haba. Shenemar, Halichos Olam Lo. Al Tikri Halichos Ella Halachos. Now what does that mean? The simple meaning is that if you learn two Halachos every day, you're guaranteed to be a Ben Olam Haba. Now what is a Ben Olam Haba? So Tosfos says everybody has a share in the world to come. But a Ben Olam Haba is a shoo-in. He gets it without any problems. No Yisurim, no suffering, he goes into Olam Haba easily. Now, just from learning two halachas every day, right, you get into Olam Haba easily, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't even say that you fulfill them. You just learn them. Just from learning two halachas every day. So I was thinking that's not what it says. What it says is, Kol Hashona Halachos Bichol Yom. If it would mean learning halachas every day, it should say, Kol Hashona Halachos Kol Yom. Person who learns halachas every day. What's Bichol Yom? That he learns halacha into every day. He sees that every physical, material thing is halacha. And that's right, halichos olam. What's halichos olam? The byways, the highways of the world. In other words, the way that you traverse this physical world leads you to Olam Haba. So halichos olam lo. If a person knows how to go through this world properly, he'll get to Olam Haba. And therefore, Habakkuk, that was his idea of combining this world, where the neshama is only a guest, but taking care of the needs of that guest in order to get to the next world. So all of these prophecies of Habakkuk fit very nicely with what he came to teach through his birth and his death and resurrection, that this world's important vis-a-vis how you traverse it to be able then to have Tchias HaMeisim to get to the future world. Both are important. And therefore his birth into this physical world was miraculous, and his death and resurrection was also miraculous. That's the lesson of Habakkuk. More or less, that's where I'm holding. I don't think I'm going to add too much more, but maybe make it a little bit more clear. But the idea, I think, is an interesting idea. Yes? Why does what? Why did he allow her to die after the Akedah? Oh, so it says, without going into great length over here, but it says, what Rashi says is, how did Sarah die? So it says that after the Akedah, the Satan came, okay, and said to Sarah, you didn't hear what happened to your son? He said, where's your son Yitzchak? He said, well, my father took him, you know, to make a sacrifice. He said, that's what he told you. He said, do you know that he almost slaughtered him? And when she heard he was almost slaughtered, she gave out a cry like a shofar, and she died. So it would seem that she died out of thinking that her son Yitzchak was killed. But it's not true. It says when she heard he was almost killed, she knew he was alive. So why'd she die? The answer is that she reached a tremendous level that even Avraham and Yitzchak didn't reach. The Michtam Eliyahu says that Avraham and Yitzchak could have reached a level where they totally went into the next world, had they been, and the world been, on the right level, but it wasn't. And therefore the Akedah had to stop just at the last moment. But Sarah Imenu came to a level of appreciating what almost happened, to the point where she couldn't stay in this world anymore, where her neshama just fled her, not out of fright and not out of bad, but out of good. A tzaddik can reach a level where his neshama just leaves him. That's called neshika. That's like God kissing you. It's like the magnet attracting the neshama can't stay in this physical world anymore. Sarah reached such a high spiritual level that her neshama was so attracted to God that it just left her body. She couldn't stay in this world anymore. She reached her purpose. She saw her son reach the pinnacle, and she was the one who brought him to that, and therefore she reached her tachlis, no purpose for her to be in this world anymore. She graduated to the next world. As I said, we're only a visitor in this world. When the time comes, you go back to your place of abode that's permanent. So when you finish your purpose here, you go back. She finished her purpose. That's why it's good for people never to feel like they finished their purpose, feel they're completely accomplished. They should always feel they have more to do. That way they can live longer, till the Rabbanu Shlom decides that they finish their purpose. But they shouldn't feel they finished their purpose here. Okay, let's go to another idea here. Back to Lech Lecha, because I think it's something important, something I wanted to speak about last time, and we left it, and it's really relevant to all of you. I think all of you were not born here in Eretz Yisrael, right? Anybody here born in Eretz Yisrael? No, we all came from somewhere else, okay? Right? No, I'm talking about England, America, okay? Anybody from somewhere else besides England and America? Huh? Oh, South Africa, okay. Huh? And? Switzerland, oh, wow. Okay, we have an international United Nations here. In any case, where? Yeah. Baghdad, wow. Oh, they really have an international... I thought I was exotic. I came from Miami. In any case, Avraham Avinu is told, I want you to go, doesn't tell him Eretz Israel, to the land I'm going to show you, and I promise you, it's going to be for your good and your benefit. We didn't speak about this last time, I don't think so, no. Good and benefit. Now what does that mean, your good and your benefit? L'hanoscha or l'tovoscha. There are many things in this world that are good for you, they are not enjoyable. Okay, they're not things you enjoy. I remember when my mother, Aleha Shalom, would tell me, eat your vegetables, it's good for you, that means it didn't taste good. Because if it tasted good, she didn't have to resort to that. It's good for you, meaning eat it anyway. But So it's good for you, but it's not enjoyable. There are many things in this world that are enjoyable, but they aren't good for you. Okay, we won't give any examples. There are plenty of things that are very enjoyable, and they're not good for you. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avraham Avinu, I'm telling you, I promise you, that if you go to Eretz Yisrael, not only will it be good for you, it'll be enjoyable too. And this is one of the tests of Avraham Avinu. The obvious question is, what's the test? If God would come to me and say, listen, I promise you, if you make a move to Timbuktu, I'm going to guarantee you it's going to be good and enjoyable, where's the test? Of course I go. We're not talking over here where some shliach aliyah told you, go to Eretz Yisrael, I promise you it's going to be good and enjoyable. Right? And then you get here and you find out, no good and no enjoyable. Okay? We're not talking about a shliach aliyah. We're talking about God. When God makes a promise, he can deliver. And he doesn't lie. Right? So, what's the problem? God promised them, go wherever I tell you, and I promise you it's going to be good. Why shouldn't he go? What's the problem? What's the test over here? I just want to say that the test was the following. Not always what's good and what's enjoyable appears to be good and enjoyable if you don't have the right perspective. If you have the wrong perspective, there could be things in this world that appear to be good, which are really not good, and things that can be enjoyable to you, which are really not enjoyable at all, if you had the right perspective on life, and vice versa. The one of the examples we always love to give is the snake was cursed that its food supply would be readily available to it all the time. That seems good and enjoyable. Readily available food supply all the time. And the Jewish people were blessed that their food supply was only one day in the desert, and every day they had to have it replenished with the mon. If the mon didn't come down, they had nothing. Couldn't save it from one day to the next. Why? It would seem to me it's good and enjoyable to have a plentiful food supply, and it's not good or enjoyable to have one day's food. The answer is it depends what your perspective is. If you're looking for a relationship with God, then it's good and enjoyable every day to have God provide your food, and not to have a readily available supply. If you're looking for food, then it's good to have food always readily available, even if it means you don't have any relationship with God. But that's not good, and it's not enjoyable to have no relationship with God. God cursed the snake and said, I don't want anything to do with you. Here's your food supply for the end of time. Don't bother me. I won't bother you. That's it. And the Jewish people, he said, I'm not going to let the day go by that you don't know that I'm giving you your food. So again, if you're looking at the physical, material things, and that's what impresses you, then having a constant food supply is good and enjoyable. And having one day's food supply is not good or enjoyable. If you're looking for a relationship with God, the opposite is true. It's good and enjoyable to have one day's food supply and a constant connection to God, and it's not good or enjoyable to have a constant food supply and no relationship with God. So it depends on your perspective. Avraham Avinu was told, I don't want you just to leave Chutz Laretz and go to Eretz Yisrael. I want you to get a new perspective on life and to understand what's important in the world and what's not important. And then you'll understand that being in Eretz Yisrael is good and enjoyable. But if you don't understand that, then being in Eretz Yisrael may be a terror, may be oppressive, if you don't understand what you're there for. If you don't understand what really is important in this world and what's not important. Right? It says Eretz Yisrael is a land that misses nothing. I think I once mentioned to you when I first came to Eretz Yisrael, I was missing plenty of things, like Skippy peanut butter, Hellman's mayonnaise, and tuna fish, that looked and tasted like something remotely like tuna fish. What? Right? Marmite, right? Other very important things. I don't know what they have in South Africa, but I do know what they have in England. In any case, so these things weren't available here. Now, Baruch Hashem, most of them are available, but they weren't then. So how could it say that Eretz Yisrael is missing nothing? The answer is missing nothing that you really need. But if it's missing, maybe you don't need it. Maybe it's not necessary for you. It's not one of the staples of life that you really need. So the test of Lech Lecha was, would Avraham Avinu be able to mold his outlook and his perception of things in order to see the bracha in Eretz Yisrael? And if he wouldn't, then he wouldn't see the good and he wouldn't see the pleasure. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But if he understood that even sometimes Yisurim could be for your good and for your pleasure, right? That, but because Yisurim are machaper on your Averis, right? No, who knows what he had before. Right? He was just now coming to a level of getting close to God. He must have had, he served idolatry when he was a kid. So who knows what kaparas he needed. So if you have the right outlook, even suffering sometimes can be something that you don't enjoy the suffering, but you appreciate it. But if you don't have any good outlook on life, then suffering is never appreciated. It's always the bad side. It's always something to complain about. So even that, if you look at it the proper way, can be enjoyable and for your good. So that was the Nisayon. And the story that goes with this is Reb Menachem Mendel Mivitebsk was a big Hasidic Rebbe who came to Eretz Yisrael about 150 years ago. And with the 40th day that he was here in Eretz Yisrael, he made a big party for all the students. So they asked him, what's the occasion? He said, I'll tell you. Before I came to Eretz Yisrael, a Kabbalist told me that every rock in Eretz Yisrael is a diamond. I would see that every rock's a diamond. I came here, I didn't see any diamonds. I saw plenty of rocks, no diamonds. And it really bothered me. So I started to fast every day during the daytime for 40 days. Today's the 40th day. Today I opened my shutters and I saw that every rock here is a diamond. Meaning that what some people look as stumbling blocks and rocks, if you have the right perspective, you see diamonds. If you don't have the right perspective, you see rocks. So Eretz Yisrael is a land that's for your good and your pleasure, but you have to have the right perspective in order to see it. So the test was, would Avraham Avinu be able to adapt himself to that that perspective? Now, another question. The last Nisayon, the last test of Avraham, was would he go and slaughter his son Yitzchak? Now, you can't understand that simply, because what test is there also? God says, I want you to take your kid that I gave you, and I want you to slaughter him. What is Avraham going to say? Sorry, I can't do that. I won't do it. I want to keep him alive. And God will give him a heart attack. He'll give him a stroke. Right? I mean, how are you arguing with? If God wants the kid dead, he can do it a million ways. So you might as well kill him and fulfill a mitzvah, then say no, and both of you will suffer, and Avraham can kill you and Yitzchak. So who are you arguing with? What's the test? Right? The answer is the test wasn't would he do it or not. The answer was, what was the test? A few different possibilities. One is that Avraham Avinu would do it, but he'd have questions on God. How can he maybe do it? He would question. And the test was, would he be able to do it with a full heart and not have any complaints or no questions? Do it, he had to do it. He had no choice. Because God could kill Yitzchak if he wanted to anyway. So what are you going to gain by not doing it, by protesting? But there's another possibility also. And that is, here, the same way that Avraham Avinu had to get the right perspective on life, and once he got those values and those goals, and he knew what God wanted, all of a sudden God throws him a curveball out of left field. Right? Those are baseball terms that I don't expect people from Baghdad or England even, or South Africa to understand, but we Americans understand it, so you can ask an American what it means. Here he gets this curveball out of left field, right? And God tells him, I want you to slaughter your son. Slaughter your son, that's against everything that Avraham Avinu held to be sacred. Animal sacrifice, not human sacrifice. Human sacrifice are idol worshippers. And here God wants him to, right? So Avraham had two choices. He could say, look, I don't understand this at all, but I know that God told me to do it. I'm going to do it even though I don't understand it. Or he could say, you know what, maybe I have to reorganize now again my value system. And maybe it's right to slaughter human beings. And he'd make up a whole way of understanding it. That would have been failing the test. God wanted him to bow to his authority, even if he didn't understand it, and not only do what he understood. We have to try to understand the mitzvahs as much as possible, but we don't do them because we understand them. We do them because God said them. And if we understand it, fine. If we don't understand it, we still do it. And if you make your mitzvah observance dependent on your understanding, and only if you understand it will you do it, then you're in for trouble. Because even if you do it, you're going to do it with an understanding and only do it the way you think, not the way that God thinks. And that was the problem of Sodom. Sodom wasn't a problem where there was a lawless place. They just reorganized their morals and their ethics to what they understood and what they wanted, right? It says that in Sodom, the judges' names were Sheker, Chazav, Lie, Deceit. That was the names of the judges. Right, meaning that they had courts, they had laws, but the laws were distorted. If everything goes according to what people understand, people can distort morals and ethics. And we know that's what Nazi Germany did. This happens all over the world. Right? In the 60s, there was the new morality. It wasn't a new morality, it was the old immorality. But they called the old immorality the new morality. All of a sudden it became okay to be immoral. Now just call it moral. It's a new morality. New morality, fine. You don't want to be immoral. So we just change the terms. And what used to be immoral now becomes moral. People can totally distort ethics, morals, unless they depend on God. God calls the shots. He's the one who defines what's moral and what's ethical, not you. And once you're deciding, according to your understanding, you can distort anything. There's a famous story, and we mentioned it in the past more than once, but I'll mention it again, that brings out this point in this coming week's Sedra. It says that Lot went to Sodom, and he was, Eliezer, the servant of Avram, went to Sodom, and he was mugged, beat up. And then they left him bleeding in the street, but he was a gibor, Eliezer, so he got up, and he chased his assailant, and he dragged him into court. They come before the judge. The judge says, what do you want? He says, I was beaten up by this man. He said, did he make you bleed? He said, yeah. He said, okay, you owe him $50 for bloodletting. In those days, they used to go to doctors to let blood. It was considered healthy. So the guy beat you up. He made you bleed. He did you a service. Bloodletting, pay him $50. Eliezer wasn't an idiot. So he hit the judge in the mouth and made him bleed. And he said, whatever you owe me, pay him. Cute medrash. What does it mean? What it means is, don't think for a minute that in Sodom there were no laws. It was a totally lawless place. No, there were laws. The laws were distorted. The whole system was distorted. But that's when people build a system of ethics and morals on their own understanding and not based on a code of ethics and morals that's God made. Okay. Yeah, that was part of the test, yes. That was the second test, though. The first test, would you go? Then it was another test. Now you're there. I told you it's going to be for your good and your pleasure, and now there's a famine. Only here. Right? No other place in the world is a famine. Only in Eretz Israel. Right? So Avraham Avinu says, God, you told me to come to this place. You told me it's going to be good and pleasurable. All of a sudden there's a famine. I have to go leave the land. So he didn't ask any questions. He said, obviously, I have to readjust my understanding of what's good and what's pleasurable. And that includes this famine, too. That was all part of that same test. Okay, yeah. Okay. That exactly was a test. What you asked, the Brisker... Reb Chaim Brisker says the following. He says, the test for Avram was, would he ask these questions? Would he say to God, look, I don't understand what's going on. First explain it to me, then I'm willing to do it, but it doesn't make any sense. Right? Not that I'm not going to do it, but you contradicted yourself. You told me yesterday that he's going to be my seed, now you're telling me to slaughter him? He doesn't have any kids. Right? You contradicted yourself. We have a rule like this. When the Torah contradicts itself, what do you do when there's two sentences in the Torah that contradict itself? Possible, right? Shnei ketuvim hamachishim zeh et zeh. What's the end of that? Ad sheyavo akosuv ashlishi. We always have a third sentence that resolves the conflict, okay? What's the ad sheyavo akosuv ashlishi? Should have said, shnei ketuvim hamachishim et zeh, akosuv ashlishi machriya. What's ad sheyavo? Says Reb Chaim Brisker, you know what the ad sheyavo means? The following. If you find two sentences that contradict each other in the Torah, don't ask any questions. You have no right to ask any questions. You just do whatever both of them are, even though it's a contradiction. It's not your worry. You have to do what you're told, without any questions. Odd, until you find the third sentence that could resolve the contradiction, then you're allowed to resolve the contradiction. Until that point, you're not allowed to ask any questions. That's the same thing. Abraham said, look, you told me this, now you told me this. There's a contradiction, okay? But there was no third sentence yet. So he had to say, look, I don't know. I don't know how this fits in with what you told me yesterday, but this is what you told me today. I have to do what you told me today. So I'm not asking any questions. Until the angel said, stop, don't do it. Now there was a third sentence. Now that Abraham said, okay, now I have a third sentence, now I have a right to try to resolve it. The resolution is, you told me to bring him up for an ola, you didn't tell me to slaughter him. Therefore you're telling me now to stop. You never mentioned slaughtering him, all you said was bring him up. I brought him up, now bring him down. So now I have a way of resolving the there's no contradiction anymore. But until there was that third sentence that the angel told him, he had to do what he was told today. Even though it contradicted what he was told yesterday, that's not within his realm. You have to listen to what God said. And that's the same thing. If the Torah tells you one thing and then tells you something else, you have to do, even though it's contradictory. Until you'll have a third sentence, then God said, now I want you to take that third sentence and resolve the contradiction. Until there's a third sentence, there's no resolution. Do, even though it's contradictory, you have to do today what you were told, even though it contradicted what it said yesterday. That was the test. The test was, would he question until he had a right to question? When he had no right to question, he didn't question. He didn't say a word, he went. Only later did he try to understand, after it was all over, what went on over here. But as he was doing it, he didn't question anything. That was the test. Test wasn't what did we do it. Test was exactly this. Would he try to question and argue with God based on logic? That he didn't do.
I think you have to prove one point to me.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think any of us are. Yeah. Yeah.
Hashem is on the Sabbath, what you saw.
Right.
He's also trying to
prove to the world. Right. He's trying to show Avram's greatness, Nisos from Nais, from a banner. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Because since God chose Avram Avinu, and he was going to make his children great, and we're going to be Am HaNivchar, he wanted the world to understand they didn't do it for no purpose, that this person deserved it, and that the world should hear about it, and they did hear about it. The Christians know about it, and the Muslims know about it, and it's a world-famous thing, what Avram Avinu did.
I mean, how did this act of the sacrifice?
A person who's willing to take the dearest thing to him and sacrifice it for the sake of God, listen to God, even though he's taking something that's the dearest thing he had, was his own son. Right? After he waited 100 years to have that son, right? It shows that this person is truly a devoted servant of the Rebbe Mishnah. Can't get higher than that. Yeah. Yes. Right, we will come and bow, Ishtachaveh, will bow down and we'll come back to you. So Rashi says that he prophesied and didn't even know what he was saying. He said, just like a Freudian slip, that we'll both come back. But he really didn't have intention of both of them coming back, but he didn't want to tell them that because they would have tried to stop him. But he said it in such a way that in the end it really turned out to be a prophecy. But he didn't say it knowing that was what really going to be. That's what Rashi says. Yeah. It's a good question. I'll give you a simple answer that they do say. What? They? That's basically the answer. The answer is, here he didn't do it for his own sake, he did it to save other people. Here it was him and his son Yitzchak, and he expected Yitzchak to be on the same level of him. So he didn't daven for Yitzchak either. But for the people of Sodom, it wasn't for his own sake. There he had a right to say to God, I don't understand, how can you harm other people? By there I can't keep quiet. And in fact, Chazal say that Avraham Avinu, he made a war with God, and he wasn't punished for it. Right? He said strong things against God. But since he didn't do it for his own purposes, he did it because of his rahmanis on other people, God overlooked it. Okay.